listening to 1 in 10 from National Children's Alliance. I'm Teresa Wezar, your host. Join us as we engage in one-on-one conversations with the brightest minds in science, medicine, faith, communications, and the law. We'll discuss the path forward to solve the greatest challenge 1 in 10 of our children face, child abuse. In today's episode, Housing Instability and Child Welfare, we examine the outsized impact that housing instability has on family well-being. How does constantly moving or changing a home affect children? And what other less talked about issues related to housing should we be aware of? I talked to Maya Brennan, Senior Policy Associate with the Research to Action Lab at the Urban Institute, about these issues. We discuss the deep cycle of cascading instabilities that has its roots in housing. How can the child welfare system help children dealing with trauma retain a deep sense of roots and resilience? And what can we as a society do to help support families in these situations? So tell me a little bit about how you came to this particular work. I know that you were a tenant advocate at one time in Baltimore. What drew you to this work?
Well, what drew me to the housing work in general was recognizing that so many people have deep needs in their lives and that I really felt drawn to give something back. I have some personal experience in the child welfare system, and that drove me in part to be a person who can't have a career that's just for my own income. And in fact, when I started the tenant landlord work, it was for a pay cut. It was really, I needed to give back.
You were
back.
Very invested in the work.
Right. I was very invested in the work.
So I can imagine you're on this hotline, you're getting all kinds of calls, right? From folks who are either worried about housing or looking for housing or having a problem with housing. And I can imagine the volume of that had to be very substantial, as it would be in any city, right?
Oh, right.
So how did it really shape your future work, answering call after call after call in that way?
Well, answering call after call, I mean, the lines would just, most of the time, all the lights are on, all the hotline operators are on the phone. Every once in a while, there'd be a lull, but most of the calls were, I'm behind on my rent and I've got a notice to go to court. And sometimes they were really serious housing conditions problems. I mean, the stories of I need to figure out how to get my landlord to do something about the rats because they're getting into my kid's crib were, you can't forget those stories.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we started to every once in a while hear a change in some of the calls where more calls were starting to come in about people asking for much higher security deposits or people asking for renters in multifamily buildings to have to pay the water bill even though they weren't metered for their water bill. So at that point, when the calls started to really change, I thought, this is time to look to see what's happening in the legislative session, because clearly the volume of calls and there's all these changes happening. Is there something that could change in the law to change what's happening on the hotline? So even though the direct service gave a lot of sense of immediate impact, you know, we knew when we were able to help someone, I felt like the only way to be able to help people in volume was to start to really focus on policy. So I went to policy school at that point.
Well, and I think it's a really common experience, actually, for people who have a policy interest, that there's some triggering event, whether it's direct service or otherwise, that you say, wait a minute, I'm putting a Band-Aid on the problem in front of me, but I'm not fixing anything upstream. And that sense of being overwhelmed by the constant volume coming in and feeling like there's only so much you can do about that, I think, is a sense that our children's advocacy centers are familiar with and usually gets them involved as well in terms of changing the public policy that they can. But let me ask you something. You know, when we look at housing in general, public housing, also affordable housing, all those things, short of millions of dollars dropping out of the sky from Congress, which I wish it were to be forthcoming, but doesn't seem likely right now.
Right.
What is it that we all can do that can be helpful?
So I think there are multiple things that every person can do. some things are about the person and some things are about systems working together to really address the things that we commonly care about. So for people, most of the time, we as individuals are not saying, you know, I want more money for something that affects my neighbors down the block. We're usually saying, I want more money for something that affects me. But if we start to recognize that we're all really in this together as a common community and a common family, and that our kids, our childcare workers are not going to be able to live in the area, or they're going to be coming to work really stressed, and that's not going to be good for their relationships with our kids if housing affordability isn't strong. So it gives us that motivation to realize why we are indeed all in this together and why we do need to fight harder for not just increased money from the federal level, which is part of it, but also changes at the local level that allow more housing to get built, that make sure that housing that's already affordable gets preserved and maintained in ways that are actually really much more cost effective than building new, but allow people to be able to afford to live in our neighborhoods. And also say, let's bring down some of the exclusionary zoning rules that prevented families of a variety of income levels from being able to live in more types of neighborhoods and really welcome everyone in. So when you bring some of those exclusionary rules down, the cost of actually delivering subsidy gets to be a lot less too.
It seems like there's so much to unpack with housing. So
yeah.
There's, for one thing, because it's a basic human need, mm-hmm. and also a basic human right, if you think about it in that sense,
right.
Paired with that. But there's the question of availability, and mm-hmm. there's the question of affordability, which is tied together. And then there's housing stability for kids, which mm-hmm. I think is something that in our universe of working with kids who've been abused, mm-hmm. you know, we see this in a variety of ways. And it shows up... it shows up in so many ways. So, for example, you could be working with a child who's been sexually abused and the abuser is their father. Mm-hmm. And suddenly that coming out winds up, we hope, not with a displacement. We hope the dad's removed from the home, but can right. yield a displacement for mm-hmm. the kid. You can wind up with a case, another child welfare case where, you know, the child's removed from the home and winds up then in a series of foster homes, which mm-hmm. we hope that wouldn't happen, but it still often does. Right. And that's its own form of housing instability. And so what do you see as the impact of this, not necessarily not having a home, but this constant moving or changing or never feeling really secure about your home? Mm-hmm. What's the impact of that on kids?
So the impact of constant churn and multiple moves and really feeling out of control about the moves and the level of stability that you have in your home environment ends up flowing into health, and especially behavioral health, and into education. So from the education context, what we end up seeing is that kids who are moving a lot, even when they're actually able to stay in the same school, can exhibit problems called learned helplessness mm-hmm. or problems with task persistence. So we expect kids often in school to be able to sit at that seat and focus on the problem until the problem's done and then behave well. And when kids are in contexts where their mind is not able to have that peace and stability of knowing that this is my home, these are my people, this mm-hmm. is all good, we start to see more challenges with that. What we also see then in the health context is that some kids are more prone to internalizing negative feelings and others more prone to externalizing negative feelings. And so the internalizers may be more prone to depression and anxiety, and the externalizers may be those aggressors in class who are having behavior problems and getting suspended
out.
And acting out. And so housing instability plays a role in all of that. We also do know from some research about kids who have experienced homelessness that if you experience homelessness as a pair with your mother or with a parent, mm-hmm. and you're not actually separated from your parent during homelessness, you're much more likely to be able to withstand and be resilient across that very serious destabilizing event. So there's something about in destabilizing situations, having a really strong support and roots that are still there. And that's where I think the supports of a really strong child welfare system come in. is when we can figure out ways to prevent the removal, or when we can figure out ways to safely reunify. And during the time that a child is in the child welfare system, make sure that they're really well supported and still feel like they have good, strong roots. All of that's important to create that buffer that allows us to withstand these really terrible situations that can happen in life.
Well, I think that, you know, when you think about a child going to school as you're describing it and not sure exactly what home they may come home to.
Right.
You know,
right.
Or that tomorrow it could be different. And perhaps the group of friends I have in the neighborhood are going to be entirely different. I think, you know, 20 years ago when I started working in this field, I don't think we really realized much about that. And so you would see often kids that would be moved. And often within a family move, right? So maybe they were taken out of their home but placed with a grandmother or whatever, which was certainly better than another alternative. But it still meant the loss often of a school, of a placement, of friends, of all those things. And those layered losses, I think, are so impactful for kids who have already been traumatized in some way with that. When you think about housing instability at large, so not only its impact on kids, but on families, you know, where does this fall kind of in the range of family stressors that families can experience?
Well, there are a lot of deep and shallow family stressors. Every family has stresses of one kind or another. But we know that income and parent employment volatility and evictions and housing stressors are huge. So somewhere around 18 million households in the U.S. are paying more than half of their income for their housing costs. And when you're paying more than half of your income on your housing costs, you're not paying what you need to for food, for healthcare, for transportation. And we know from some research from colleagues, Sandy Newman and Scott Holupka, we know that even when families are not paying that severe amount for housing, that they're paying less on child enrichment activities. And so what we see with income instability and then deep housing cost burdens is that just having books in the home starts to fall out. Being able to have clothes that are appropriate for that school event where they say, you know, you need to have a pair of black pants and a white shirt. And that it starts with some of these little pieces, but then it goes all the way up to quite serious stressors.
I think it's interesting to think about that cascading effect because, you know, often in public policy work, we're really looking for some kind of lever into the system, right? There's so many problems you could work on and try to solve. And you may or may not, some are more impactful than others. You know, you can work on one area that this relates to and it will have some impact and certainly for the family in front of you, but might not have the type of impact you're describing. It sounds as though when you're talking about housing affordability and instability, that it's one of those things that has an outsized impact on a family's well-being. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. Housing instability is really the root of all other cascading instabilities, and sometimes in a deep cycle with them. So housing instability may be at the start, but it may continue to flow in. And when we think about evictions, for example, we can think of evictions as being the start of a whole channel of other ripple effects. But some people see eviction as being the last thing after you've lost your job because of other reasons, and then you're evicted. Well, then once you're evicted, it's actually much harder to keep your job, to find a new job, to get a new place to live. I mean, evictions and even just the filing for an eviction, whether it was received or not, stays on a tenant's record in most states forever.
Really? That's interesting.
So there are a few places that actually seal or expunge records after a period of time or if a tenant requests it and the landlord agrees. But otherwise, if you're in a tight rental market, like a lot of markets are today, and landlords are looking at two different applicants, they'll see, oh, this person, somebody filed against them 5 years ago for eviction. I don't see any other problems, but that makes me weigh them worse than the person that doesn't have that filing. And so Evictions can be a really big problem.
Well, they're catastrophic, really, in the way you're describing them. And I think one of the things when we think about our work in family violence is that sometimes someone might wind up in a position to be evicted because of a whole series of events that their family has experienced, that they themselves have as a victim of domestic violence or other things that may cause that. And I'm betting that's not noted on the form, or if it is, it's probably not... it's not impacting that in a positive way anyway.
No. And there is a bit of a movement to remove domestic violence as a cause for eviction. So often the reason that domestic violence directly becomes a cause for eviction is that there's a nuisance law that says if you have so many calls from police or emergency services to your property, we're going to think that you're a nuisance in the neighborhood. Mm. Well, if you have a kid who is a roughhouser and falling on their own, or if you have a domestic violence situation against parent or child in the house, and you have ambulance calls there, or if you have someone that you have a protective order against and you're calling the police when they come to the house that they don't even live in, in some states that don't have these nuisance protections against eviction, you can end up evicted for that as well.
That's so interesting. And I think that, you know, one of the difficult things is for your neighbors, it might be a nuisance. Right. I mean, honestly, right. You know, there is that element of it. However, I'm not sure your neighbors would want the catastrophic impact of that to happen to you and your family.
Right.
I think they, you know, basically just want to stop hearing sirens. They don't want you to be out of your house with your kids on the street, you know. Right. Those kinds of things. Do you feel like the public in general is aware at all of these types of housing issues?
No, I think they fly so under the radar. Yeah. And then we also don't really have a culture of calling a mediator or calling social services. We have a culture of calling 911 for whatever type of emergency. And so you see something that is truly an emergency in this person's life.
Yeah.
And the sirens come, and it can be, as you know, a nuisance to have, you know, if this is, you live next to a house where the sirens are always coming, but is the way to get that to stop to have the person removed from the house or to have the violence addressed in a more community-friendly way.
Well, and you can also see how some abusers would use that as a way to stalk somebody and make their life continually miserable. Mm-hmm. You just keep showing up,
right.
And they keep getting displaced. So, you know, it's interesting about how to respond to these things in a way that's really responsible both to the community and to the family themselves. I'm wondering if you can, when you think about all the programs you've seen over the years that have worked with families in difficult situations, whether with housing instability or whether with affordability or other things, can you point to some really positive examples where you say, you know, these are some examples of the types of programs that are really effective and that we should have more of?
Yeah. So when families can have a permanent housing subsidy, we know from randomized control trials that a permanent housing subsidy, which let me say for a second, that permanent doesn't mean for that family's whole life, but it means without a specific time limit on it, without saying you have a subsidy for a year.
Right.
When a family can have a housing subsidy that they can rely on, that reduces re-involvement in homeless services systems. We know this through a study called the Family Options Study that compared to letting a family stay in an emergency shelter and try to find their way out, putting them into transitional housing with supports or providing a regular housing choice voucher or access to public housing, that permanent subsidy, public housing or a housing choice voucher, is much more effective and including cost effective generally than, you know, any other way of trying to address family homelessness. So that's one thing that has been really quite promising. Other programs that have been really promising are when systems start to align together and try to work together. So in a set of five sites over the country, there was a demonstration to look at what happens when you combine some deep intensive supportive services with a connection to a housing provider in the area for families who are involved in the child welfare system. And my colleagues, Mary Cunningham and Mike Pergamit, had been part of working on this randomized control trial. And what they found was that families who were in the treatment group, who actually got that housing support with the supportive services, were much more likely to be on their own lease for an apartment or a rented house within that year after our enrollment. We're in some of the sites that we're doing a little bit better. We're much less likely to have the child removed from the home and more likely to also have a child who had been out of the home be reunified. So we know that that's working. And there's some efforts in places like Cuyahoga County to try to figure out, can we replicate this? And how do we get to be able to fund this mm-hmm. when we're still really proving that housing is not just that stressor that can lead to family stress and involvement in a child welfare system, but that housing can actually offer a door out and a place for these sorts of deep supports that can help families get back on their feet.
Well, what's so interesting about that to me is, you know, I think one of the things that can be distressing, I guess is the only word I can think of for this, but if you sit in family court, one of the things that strikes you is the frequency within which people are just not following their treatment plan. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, they're mm-hmm. not following their treatment plan. And the cascading impacts of that when mm-hmm. the court sees that's not happening. But you're also aware that some of that, perhaps not all of it, but some of it may be that if you don't have your basic needs met, it's really hard to worry about getting to the counseling appointment on time right. or, you know, making sure you're at your addiction treatment program on the appropriate time and hour because you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something very hopeful about the idea mm-hmm. of providing housing with some supportive services, which then lets you essentially see what the actual baseline of the family function is.
Right.
And I don't know how you know that when somebody's very worried every single moment about where they're going to sleep, where their family's going to be, and if they're going to have children removed, if they are in a very unstable mm-hmm. situation. You know, how do you even assess what the family's essential functioning is?
I think that's a great way to put it, that you do finally get a sense of what a family's baseline is when you are not struggling with your most significant basic needs. I mean, every person, if you don't know where you're going to sleep that night, and if you are concerned that you may have to pick up and move at any moment, you're going to be very stressed. You're not going to be at your best at all. And too often we expect that families who come in to any form of social service, especially the child welfare system, should be on their absolute best behavior to try to comply with all of the rules that are put before them and to be really striving. But if you were waking up in a situation that was not at all tenable, or if the first is coming and you know you don't have money for the first to come, then how are you really going to show up?
Well, and I think that's such a good point, because I think sometimes if we're not careful, the plan can start at the top of the pyramid, you know, with the most it's not even demanding requirements, but they're emotionally demanding. Mm-hmm. You know, they demand that you attend mm-hmm. to your emotional well-being, which is very hard to do if you're hungry or cold or worried sick right. about where you're going to be. And I think that for children's advocacy centers, you know, that's something that we really think about, is how do we marshal the resources of our multidisciplinary team to look at those issues of child and family well-being as a whole, mm-hmm. you know, what piece of that? We know we're going to have to eventually work on all of those pieces that are going to help a child be safe in the home. But which piece do we start with,
right.
I think, is often a question that we have. And it seems like taking a look at housing is going to be a really mm-hmm. important part of that equation.
Right, right. And I think that there is growing awareness that for people with very, very low incomes, near the poverty line or maybe up to 200% of the poverty line, that housing instability is actually adding a lot of not just cost to their lives and cost to communities, but cost to society. So there was some research around homelessness that led to bipartisan support for more resources to address chronic adult homelessness because of the cost to other systems. So if we can address also the sort of human case and cost case around the need and value of maybe universal housing assistance for people below a certain level on the income scale, we could have this sort of support that allows families to function better, that prevents all of these problems, that allows us to have a full generation of kids who grow up with the types of supports that allow them to really thrive.
So maybe putting on your tenant advocate hat back for just a second, imagine that you're sitting in a multidisciplinary team meeting at one of our local children's advocacy centers. So it's going to be their staff, there's going to be law enforcement, social services, prosecutors, mental health, medical personnel, victim advocates, and they're all talking about the child in front of them. Mm-hmm. And maybe they've never really considered this housing question before. What are the questions they should be asking each other and the group to really think about this in a deep way and its impact on what's going on with this family?
I think it starts with, do you know where you're going to lay your head tonight? And if you don't know where you're going to lay your head tonight, then where did you lay your head last night? And kind of trying to slowly peel back that onion of exactly how stable or unstable is this family's life, and is their family's home? And what more might you be able to do? So, and another piece would be reminding and asking about not just, well, why aren't you going to a shelter system or where have you gone, but what sort of options have you considered for a place to sleep tonight and what options are really not on the table for you? Because a lot of families do not have any interest in being in a really potentially dangerous emergency shelter in their area. Others have had better experiences with them. This is a pretty broad, there's a pretty broad spectrum of how good emergency shelters are and how safe they are for families. So starting with just really the basics and also centering that person's experience rather than saying, hey, I want to tell you that you need to use this shelter.
There's something really empowering about asking someone what they've considered and why or why not, because you're already getting them to be thinking and articulating that, as opposed to, you know, often when we see families, we're seeing them in crisis, which can be a somewhat passive place because you're in such shock. You know, you've had this traumatic experience. You're not really sometimes able to really think clearly, because you're focused, obviously, on the trauma that's just occurred or isn't in front of you. And I think it's good to engage someone in that kind of way so that they can see not just that you're paying attention to what they're saying, but that you're a person whose opinions matter. You know, there's that element of it as well.
Right. Yeah, there's some work that a group called the U.S. Partnership on Mobility from Poverty had done, where they were thinking about what does it mean to have mobility from poverty? And they decided that it was really a three-pronged definition. Part of it is economic, and part of it is about power and autonomy, and part of it is about a sense of belonging. And so I think for families who are experiencing any sort of othering, whether it's poverty or being on the other side of the table at a child welfare agency, that sense of, are we making sure that you're making strides, and are we allowing you to have a feeling of belonging here, and that this process is really your process, and that you have some power, and that you have some say
as opposed to one just being inflicted on you, essentially.
Right.
So let's talk for a moment about something else that impacts kids, which is dangerous housing. And I think sometimes when we think about that, we think about it strictly in the context of community violence. But actually, there are lots of things in housing that can be dangerous to them, as dangerous maybe even as community violence, but that are sort of hidden in a certain way, or maybe not as readily apparent. Can you just sort of talk about those kind of environmental things that could be lead or other things that kids are exposed to that we may not be thinking of, but that may impact their development and other things?
So on the community violence side, one thing that can happen is that kids may actually be kept in their home a lot more by a really strong positive caregiver, potentially leading to more problems of obesity and of children not actually running and getting that active play. So that's it's an interesting flip side of what you see there, where whether the kid is being protected or not as protected, being exposed to community violence can be really serious problem. But housing has so many other quality problems, from lead to mold, and the impact of the combination of mold and cockroaches and mice or rats all leads to serious asthma problems, and kids are much more likely to face hospitalizations and more severe asthma attacks when they're in housing that has all of these sort of quality problems. There's also a lot of housing in the country that just has very basic tripping hazards all over the place, just is in enough disrepair that kids could be falling down off of that loose rung on the stairs, or the floorboard that's up and the exposed nails from it, exposed wiring. I mean, there are houses for rent in DC right now that have wiring problems that would be a serious fire risk and electrical health risk for kids.
And when you think about kids who might be presenting with health problems like asthma, I'm thinking within the CAC context again, you know, we do head-to-toe exams of kids because often they're coming in for sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. But honestly, the most common finding is not some symptom of that, although they may be sexually abused. It's other health problems that they have. It could be a dental carry. It could be heart murmurs. It could be asthma. It could be anything. And often we find that they don't have a primary care provider at all. And so the physician or the nurse, as a part of the Children's Advocacy Center, is trying to help them find kind of a medical home. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because I don't know that I was really thinking of that in the context of perhaps that health problem is actually created by the housing that they're in.
Right.
So what questions should a provider ask when they're encountering that? You know, because I think sometimes we think, well, maybe they're exposed to smoke, maybe, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But we're not really thinking that it could be these other things in their home environment that actually could be ameliorated.
Yeah. Well, it's important to ask about things like rugs and the age of the rugs, about whether there's any sort of pests or vermin. Sometimes you ask about pets and don't remember to ask about the unwanted animals in the home.
Yeah, which are not pets, right?
They are, yeah, absolutely, clearly not pets, right? But there was an example of a... I once heard a pediatrician on stage talking about asthma problems and saying, you know, she was in an interview with a family and asking the parents about what are some of the things happening in the home and do you have pets, and trying to kind of understand the kid's environment. And the parent said, no, I don't have any pets. And the kid said, well, mommy, what about the rats?
Oh,
it's like, not... not something that should go missed. And, you know, we need to actually think and remember that a lot of homes have, whether it's, you know, rugs that are 30 years old because the housing has really not been maintained, or serious leaks that lead to mold and asthma. So having a couple more questions about the home environment would be very useful.
Well, and thinking about victim advocacy, which we're very adept at, but adding to it some elements of inquiring about these things, and also in the same way we advocate for better conditions in other ways, really taking that opportunity to connect with programs who have an expertise in advocating on those issues, I think could be really, really important.
Right.
Because, you know, you want the child to be well in terms of their mental health, but you also have to pay attention to their physical health as well, which is deeply impacted, I think, by these kinds of conditions. When you think about those sort of public policy environment we're in, and what is the sort of public policy dream that if you could have it tomorrow, you know, you're sort of number one or number two, you said, if everyone would just advocate for this, this would make such a difference. What is it?
I think the start of my public policy dream would be to have a sufficient money for capital needs for public housing. Because we as a nation are housing a lot of families, with the U.S. being their landlord, and not putting any money into the repair of the properties. And so as units of public housing go further and further down the quality line, and then we have to move families out of them, they're losing affordability and they're losing their housing quality all at the same time. Now, when families have to be moved because of that, they do get a voucher to move somewhere else, but into tight rental markets where we know that the ability of a family to actually use their voucher is not always there.
Well, and I think the other issue is that as these, I'm thinking of a housing community that's not far from where I used to live. And I think that if they're not kept up, the other thing is, what message are we sending people, mm-hmm. really? That taxpayers don't care about right. the conditions that they live in? I mean, it's concerning, I think, in a public policy way from that perspective as well. And we can't be terribly surprised, I think, that if we sort of incur, if we don't take care of those properties, nothing good is going to come from that, you
right.
know?
Right.
There can't possibly be any good outcome from neglect, whether it's of a person or a property or anything else.
Right. It sends terrible signals about what the country thinks of the people and what the country thinks of the community and what the community should think of the people there, and leads to further stigmatization, which only furthers stress for everyone and, you know, doesn't allow kids to feel like they belong and families to feel like they belong and have anyone start to look and think ahead to their future in a really positive, kind of self-affirming way.
So if you had one piece of advice for all 900 children's advocacy centers across the country in terms of working on this issue, what would it be?
There are lots of housing providers in your area, and they can be partners. You don't have to do the housing piece of it yourself, but it would be great to have a phone call with whether it's the Public Housing Authority or a private landlord, a nonprofit that works on housing, and just say, if we think that a family has housing problems, how do we send them over to you? And what could we maybe do in partnership?
That's great. Well, you know, I think children's advocacy centers have a long history of creative partnership, so I think they're going to be really energized by this conversation. Is there any question that I should have asked you and didn't, Maya?
Oh, that's always the hardest one, because there's always so many places. But I think one other piece that's important to think about with children's advocates is that children are affected by their own home, but they're also affected by the conditions of the homes in their neighborhood. So there's some research in Cleveland that found that distressed housing, not just your own, but living near other properties that are really in poor quality, also tends to affect child welfare involvement.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And it seems like it's through the stress of the parents in the neighborhood that when you're just exposed to that level of stress, of seeing your neighborhood decay around you, that it's another factor, usually along with so many other factors in your life, that that just kind of the last piece of hay on that haystack.
You know, it's just a reminder that we're all in it together, you know,
right.
And so much so for kids, you know, that we can't let conditions around them decay and their own experience be so horrible and then expect that they're going to lead lives that thrive. But this mm-hmm. is a real opportunity to intervene on their behalf and help their entire family and strengthen it in a way that will go on long beyond, I think, the involvement of the Children's Advocacy Center, or at least we can hope so.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to talking to you again, Maya.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to 1 in 10. We hope you'll tune in for our next episode when we'll talk to Marcy Hamilton, legal scholar and CEO of Child USA, about achieving justice for victims of child sexual abuse. For more information about National Children's Alliance and the work of Children's Advocacy Centers, visit our website at www.nationalchildrensalliance.org.